Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, lately we've had a series of women scientists on as guests on American Variety. There are more women in the sciences than there used to be, and in particular in biology, where more than half, or actually 53% a year or so ago, of the PhDs in biology are awarded to women. But that's unusual. In mathematics, it's 28%, and in physics, only 19%. And so I think that women tend to be attracted to biology maybe because it's less math intensive, but also maybe because it deals more with living things rather than with abstract concepts and inanimate objects. And you know, I'm guessing that comes into play in field choices like that. But my guest today is a doctoral candidate in biology at East Tennessee State University, which is the home of American Variety's flagship station WETS. But I have to say that her research deals with a living thing that most women would rather run from than get close to, spiders. Her name is Jennifer Price. Let's talk with her about it. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on. So you're interested in spiders.
Yes, I am.
I guess that means you're probably not arachnophobic.
No, not anymore.
Oh, were you to start with?
They haven't always been my favorite creatures, and I never actually saw myself working with them in research. And the way that I came to work with them was actually a long and interesting story. But I'll just say that they turned out to be the best candidate for the type of research that I wanted to do for my doctoral research.
So now, is there such a thing as arachnophilia, where you love spiders?
Actually, I think arachnophilia used to be a video game back in the 80s, but I would probably consider myself an arachnophile now, yes.
Okay, an arachnophile. All right, so you're deep into spiders. So tell us about your research.
Basically, I am a behavioral neurobiologist, so I'm interested in animal behavior, lots of different types of animal behavior. Specifically, I look at differences in neurochemistry between social and aggressive individuals within a species. Overall, my main overarching question in my research has been, how does sociality evolve or develop in a particular species?
Okay, so what's unique about that particular species that you study? And I gather you study one species that has this mixture between aggressive behavior and social behavior.
Yes, I study a species called Anolosimus studiosus. It doesn't have a common name, unfortunately, but it's a small spider that has a large range from Argentina all the way up to southern Pennsylvania. And within that range, it exhibits quite a few different levels of sociality. Throughout most of the range, it is solitary and aggressive like most other spiders. But as you get to the northern and southernmost areas of the range, we start to see more occurrences of sociality and actually the development of some colonies with multiple social females and their offspring.
So how many total species of spiders roughly, and I imagine we don't even know really, but how many do we know roughly exist?
Right now, currently, there are about 45,405 species that are known. And this list is updated constantly at two different websites. One is the World Spider Catalog that is maintained by Norm Platnick. And then there's another World Spider Catalog that's maintained by the Natural History Museum in Bern, Switzerland.
Okay, so out of 45,000 species, that's a lot of spiders. How many have this kind of social cooperative characteristic of the one that you study?
The truly social ones, there are only about 25 species that are considered truly social. There are a lot of varieties or variations within levels of sociality that are exhibited that include more species. But with regard to the way the behavior is in this particular species, only about 25 other species have it.
So that's a really, really tiny percentage.
Yes.
It's obviously very rare for spiders to be social. So I guess mainly they're just you know, kind of solitary individuals who hang out on a web waiting for lunch.
Yes, yes.
And so, okay. So then it's good that you've got this one species in this area of East Tennessee where you're located. And out of those 25 or so, are some of them all social and some of them are mixed, individual, aggressive, and social, or what?
Yes, we have several behavioral analyses that we perform in the lab to determine whether an individual is social or solitary aggressive. And we do find that there are intermediates in between, and we have a continuous scale on which we score them.
Okay, so out of the species, though, those that are social, are some of those species all social and some of them are mixed, like you're saying?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, there are some that are all social. And within the range that I was talking about for Anolosimus studiosus, there are other members of that genus that are all social in the tropical regions, whereas this species in the tropical regions, they're all aggressive and solitary. It's only when you get to the subtropical regions or the pantropical regions that they become social.
Hmm. So what form does the social take? I mean, is it a bunch of them cluster on a single web, or how does that work?
Yes, basically they build individual webs that all merge together to form one really large web or colony, sometimes spanning an entire tree and sometimes even half of an acre.
Wow, that'd be a mess to get into.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so in a single web, no matter how big it is, are all of the spiders related? Are they all cousins somehow or other, or are they different groups?
Typically in a social colony or a social web, most of the individuals, especially the females, are related. Sometimes you will find males that have wandered into the web or the colony that are not related, but for the most part they are, which causes a problem with inbreeding.
Oh, yeah, I would think, yeah. So, all right, then if you looked at the chemical differences, I guess, in this species between the ones that are solitary and aggressive on the one hand and those that are social and cooperating on the other hand, I guess that's the core of your research, really. What do you find as being the chemical or physiological differences between those two types within that same species?
What I've found so far using a technique called high-performance liquid chromatography with electrochemical detection is that there is a difference in a couple of particular neurochemicals, and I mainly look at serotonin and octopamine. For the most part, serotonin is higher in the individuals and the colonies and the populations that exhibit more social behaviors. And octopamine is higher in the solitary, aggressive individuals and colonies and populations.
Hmm. This is something I should probably know, but are there male and female spiders? I guess they are, right?
Yes.
They mate, so.
Yes.
Okay. So then do you find that there are gender differences in these chemicals? I mean, are the aggressive chemicals more prevalent than the males, for example?
We haven't actually looked at gender differences in these neurochemicals in the species that I study. We have, just for fun, looked at it in a couple of other species, and yes, there are some differences. But the reason I focus mainly on females is because in this particular species, they are the ones that basically control the society. They're the ones that build the webs and capture the food and raise the young. The males basically just function to reproduce, and they just take whatever leftovers there are as far as food is concerned. They're not very active in the society.
Well, they've kind of got it made, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Useless.
Pretty much.
So, does nearly useless. Did they all start out being born with the solitary trait, and then individuals will evolve to be social, or are they born one way or the other? Do you know?
In this particular species, they're actually born to be mostly social because the females, when they produce an egg sac, they defend the egg sac and they wait until it's time. They open the sac and the babies come out, and they actually feed them regurgitatively for a while until they're able to capture prey on their own and feed independently, which is pretty rare in the spider world also. So the young actually stay in the natal web for a long time before they disperse as solitary individuals. And during that period of time while they're developing, they become more and more solitary and aggressive until they finally leave the web and form their own. In the social colonies, they start out social and remain social. And they stay together through their lifetimes. That's how the colonies become so large.
So that sounds genetic. I mean, you got the gene to be one or the gene to be the other.
Yes, it is determined somewhat by genetics. Another interesting thing is that in most spider species, in general and throughout history, they start out as solitary species, and then every so often throughout evolution, some species evolve to become social. But the natural state is solitary for spiders.
So which one is more prevalent? How common are the social groups?
In spiders in general?
No, in this species.
In this species, only about 17% actually social.
Okay. But the females tend to be more social, but only 17% of the spider groups are social.
So only 17% of this particular species,
species
occur as social colonies. So the most part and throughout most of their range, they are solitary and aggressive. So that's one of the things that piqued our curiosity about this particular species.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And in case you just tuned in and wondering what the heck we're talking about, we're talking with Jennifer Price, who's a PhD candidate at East Tennessee State University, about her research in a certain species of spiders that are highly unusual in that there are two groups or types within that species, and some are kind of like most spiders are. They're solitary and aggressive, and they sit on their web and wait for prey or whatever, and they don't interact much with other spiders. But another subgroup of that species are very social, and they build big webs that she said can be as big as an acre, I guess, and full of spiders that all cooperate in some ways. So in those groups of cooperating spiders, is there cooperation among different groups? I mean, if you've got adjoining social webs, do they kind of sometimes merge into one big happy commune, or do the cooperating groups pretty much stick to themselves as they're formed originally?
It's a little bit of both. The females, adult females, will build and maintain a small section of web for themselves and their offspring. But as the offspring grow and develop, they will go from their web to another web, and basically they're all interconnected. And the difference between the socials and the solitaries in this particular species is mainly that they tolerate one another a lot more readily than a solitary spider does. For instance, if a conspecific or a spider of the same species wanders into the web of a solitary or aggressive spider of the species, then there will be a fight, and sometimes it ends in death. Whereas in the social webs, if a female wanders into another female's web, most of the time they just tolerate each other and don't do anything. And if there is an interaction, it's not extremely aggressive. But the interesting part about the species is that if an adult female dies before her offspring are raised to a point of independence, then another female will actually raise the offspring, her offspring. So there is a huge benefit of this arrangement, especially in environments like ours where we can have some pretty harsh winters and it gets cold.
Yeah, okay, so that was what I was going to ask you next. So from an evolutionary survival standpoint of the species, which strategy is more successful? So you've just kind of named one thing, which is that the social spiders, they raise children like a village, right? So they raise them all together, whereas the solitary ones, if the parent is eaten by a bird, then the kids are out of luck.
Exactly.
So that's one thing. But what are the other, I mean, overall, since the solitary ones are more prevalent, you know, that would kind of indicate that they're more successful, but in being more aggressive maybe is more successful. I guess it all depends, like you said, environmental factors. It all depends on how cold the weather is and how much prey or predators are around and that kind of thing. So what goes into play there, and which overall is more successful, do you think?
The more successful strategy is very highly dependent on the microclimate of the particular area that a spider or a colony of spiders has decided to live. So in this area, we have some social colonies that are literally 100 yards from a solitary colony, meaning that there are a lot of individual solitary spiders in the same tree, for instance. Just on the lakes here, it depends on the amount of sunlight that an area gets. It depends on how close it is to a dam. The TVA here has built a lot of dams. Right below the dam, cool water from beneath the lake comes out and creates a colder microclimate, whereas right above the dam, maybe not that far as a crow flies, it would be a better strategy because the water is warmer for a spider to be solitary or independent, and below the dam, a better strategy to be social and form colonies.
So no simple answer, really, but it's it all depends. Well, in case my listeners are wondering why I'm focusing so much on this particular little topic here, which is probably more specific than many of the things we get into in on American Variety, it's because I want to ask you to keep in mind the parallels with possible human behavior and connections that Jennifer Price has found in her research on this little species of spiders. And when I read it, I could see, particularly when they start talking about the chemicals in the spiders and how that determines their behavior, I could see some possible parallels with the way humans behave. And my next question is kind of along that line. Is the motivation, Jennifer, is the motivation for greater cooperation in the spiders in the cooperative social colonies, do you have any way of knowing whether it's really at its heart self-interest, whether that's just basically something that helps them survive better given the different factors that you kind of described? Or, I mean, otherwise, if it's not just self-interest, then there would have to be some kind of higher motivation toward the survival of the group as a whole, which would be hard to feature spiders having, but who knows, right? So I guess what's the advantage of sociality for the individual beyond just the individual's survival? Do you have any way of knowing that?
Yes. In behavioral ecology in general, we like to study how sociality benefits different groups of animals. And in this case, the benefit does extend beyond just the individual. And like I was saying about the likelihood of the offspring surviving in a cooler microclimate for this particular species is a long-term advantage or a long-term benefit that doesn't necessarily benefit the individual. The mother may very well perish because of the cooler microclimate, but she's ensuring the longevity of her offspring and, in essence, her own genes by forming these colonies and protecting them from death if she dies. And that seems to be the case with many other animal species as well. There is, in some instances, and this has been an argument in science for a long time, group selection. So let's say, for instance, that a particular spider has a genetic mutation that allows it to be more tolerant of conspecifics or other members of the same species, and then it happens to end up in a cooler microclimate and its offspring happen to survive longer than the others, then that creates a benefit and more offspring with that genetic mutation that make it more tolerant. So it's easier for social colonies to form in that environment.
Yeah, so it may just kind of happen that way because of the way natural selection occurs, you know, and there's no kind of group think on
right.
the part of the spiders that, okay, we have to do it this way. But humans do think that way.
Yes.
I mean, you know, and who knows whether higher forms of animals like packs of wolves may think that way in terms of, I got to sacrifice myself because if I do, the group will survive. And if I mm-hmm. don't, half of us will die. So I wonder whether, that's just total speculation, I guess, whether there's some sort of level of group think or group consciousness. But I guess it, in the case of the spiders, it just happens that way, that some circumstances lead to this kind of behavior, helping the group as a whole to survive, and some circumstances don't, right? So,
mm-hmm.
well, let's see. Let's continue talking a little bit about how this might apply to humans. So you mentioned a couple of chemicals, serotonin and octopamine, right?
Yes, octopamine.
Do humans have octopamine? I've clearly never heard of it.
We produce octopamine in very, very small traces, and it doesn't seem to do anything in humans, but it is the counterpart of our noradrenaline or norepinephrine.
Oh.
So it functions in basically the same way in spiders that our noradrenaline functions in us.
And so is noradrenaline the opposite of adrenaline, or does noradrenaline
stimulate? No, it's similar.
It's a stimulant.
Similar. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So octopamine is the one that the more aggressive solitary ones have?
Yes.
Okay.
They both have them. It's just in different amounts.
Different balances.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so then serotonin is the one that the more sociable ones have. So if we compare more aggressive solitary people with more sociable and cooperative people, I wonder if we find the same differences in biochemistry that the more cooperative social people would have more serotonin, do you know?
I do think that that has been shown in humans, that serotonin leads to more happy, less aggressive humans. And in the case of society and social interactions, a lot of times more serotonin leads to being like higher up in rank, especially in primates. I don't know about humans, but in chimpanzees, yes, the more serotonin they have, the higher up in rank they are in their little individual group.
Yeah, my impression is that serotonin is kind of a happiness and confidence-building drug. I mean, I think some antidepressants are called serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which means that they leave more serotonin in the body, which leaves you feeling happier. So,
exactly, yes.
So I'm wondering whether, again, to anthropomorphize this to a ridiculous degree, I'm wondering whether the cooperative spiders that have more serotonin are kind of happier spiders.
I wouldn't use the word happier because that's an emotion that, yes, I associate mostly with humans and only certain animals. But I would say that, yes, more serotonin equals more tolerance in spiders.
Okay. So since we have this kind of dichotomy here and maybe there's an evolution overall from solitary and aggressive to more social and cooperative, generally speaking, given certain environmental conditions, I don't know, do you think there are any parallels or conclusions we can draw from this about human society?
I like to think so. That's what got me interested in studying this in the first place, is I've always been extremely interested in how sociality developed in human society. And I do think that in general, we can study animal species and animal model systems and draw a lot of conclusions about humans. However, we have to be very careful as scientists in translating what we find in animal models to humans directly. But we can use the information from studies like this to inform human studies. But as most people might imagine, it's very hard to study human beings for many reasons. Mostly when they know that they're being observed or watched, they don't behave naturally. But also the amount of paperwork involved is ridiculous when studying humans. But yeah, I think that we can draw some conclusions safely, but we have to be careful in how we phrase those conclusions.
Well, talking about the nature of research, how do you observe your spiders? Do you go out in the field and find these big nests and sit and watch them by the hour, or how do you do this?
We do. We have quite a few people that work in our lab, and some are more involved in the field aspect of the research, and they do a lot of field observations, and we also set up video recording equipment and environmental condition recording equipment so we can track changes in the humidity and temperature and length of days and weather, things like that. And then we can analyze the video footage, which we do. We have a lot of students that sit in front of a computer and minute by minute write down what the spiders are doing. And we actually get a lot of information from those studies. Me, I go out and collect the spiders and bring them to the lab and separate them into individual containers and then do behavioral assays that way to determine whether or not they're more social or less social.
Okay, so you don't observe them and take notes on them in the wild. You go out and collect them in the wild and bring them in the lab and have them build a web there, and then you observe them in a more controlled environment.
Yes, I do particularly. But I combine my information with the people who are doing the field observations as well.
So I guess the same thing you mentioned a minute ago about human observation research affecting the results, because knowing you're being watched changes the way you behave. Do you think it might be different if you're actually sitting in the grass watching a web out in the field for 4 hours straight versus bringing them into a lab in a different kind of environment entirely and having them build a web and then watching that? Is their behavior possibly different?
It's possible that it does change their behavior to a degree, but from what we've noticed so far, it doesn't change it very much. Their behavior is pretty innate, and they don't seem to know or care whether or not they're being watched. We also keep them in a dark room sometimes and just watch them with a red light, which they can't detect. So they don't sense our presence. But when I combine one individual and another individual into one container, they basically interact with one another the exact way that they do in the field.
What do you feed them, out of curiosity?
We feed them termites and fruit flies.
Okay. Do you buy those somewhere? You have to go collect the termites and fruit flies?
We collect them from the wild.
Do you really?
We bury little pallets of cardboard, uh-huh. And the termites bore into it and use them as homes, and they make babies in there and they eat the cardboard. So we just go out and collect those and bring them into the lab and keep them in a container, and they last quite a while. And then the fruit flies, we maintain colonies of those in the lab also.
That's interesting. Again, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with PhD candidate Jennifer Price in the biology department at East Tennessee State University about her research on spiders and the social life of spiders, in particular one little species that has some unusual characteristics in that some of them are solitary and aggressive, like most spiders are, and others are very cooperative and social and build these huge nests, sometimes with lots and lots of spiders in them that all cooperate with each other. So Jennifer, let's turn, if we can, to the social topic that I led off with, which is the participation of women in the sciences. And as I said at the beginning, there are many more women in biology than there are in most other fields of science, and in engineering and physics and things like that. It's like, you know, around 20% or less, you know, which is a lot less than the population. In biology, it's pretty much 50-50 or close to it. So that's what you'd kind of ideally expect to see. But do you see a more or less gender equality in the biology department at your university? And I don't mean to single out, you know, ETSU, but I mean, I'm just wondering whether you see the same things when you attend conferences. So across the field, what do you see as far as gender equality?
Across the field, from what I have seen, and I will say I'm not, I don't have my PhD yet, but just from all of the conferences I've attended and the interaction I've had with the department here, I think there is a lot of equality that exists between males and females, but it changes as you go up as far as level is concerned. And when you get more into like chair of the department or administration, there are more males than females. And I have had the opportunity to be on a couple of search committees and selection committees for different positions in our department as the graduate student representative. And what I have noticed is that, yes, all of the members of the committee are equally accepting of males and females as candidates, but there are not as many females that apply for the positions as males from what I have seen so far.
Hmm. So the solitary aggressive ones are at the top of the food chain,
yes,
or whatever. But I mean, so it sounds like, and that's true really of so many fields, that there tends to be a glass ceiling, even though there are many more women in the workforce, no matter where it is, out in industry or whatever. Moving up beyond, let's say, middle management gets tougher and tougher with each step. And so you're seeing the same thing in biology and administration, basically, that there's more professional opportunities for the higher levels of management and administration for males, or at least the opportunities are theoretically there for women, but they're actually in reality given more often to men.
I think so. And I think that a lot of it has to do with many women who are of the age where they would want to take on such a responsibility as being chair or whatever in administration also are at the same age where they're having families or they're caring for young children, and they don't want to give up that much of their time or their lives to necessarily to that position. But I wouldn't say that even here in East Tennessee, where things are sometimes a little farther behind than other areas in the country, I wouldn't say that there's a lot of discrimination against women that I have seen anyway. Not anymore. I think that it was like that at one point.
Yeah, and there probably tends to be a kind of a self-selecting continuing factor to it, that if there are more men on the selection committees because there are more men in administration, then they might tend, whether they intend to consciously or not, they might tend to select men to be new administrators more often than women, because men may appear to them to be more the right type because, gee, I'm the right type and he's more like me or something, you know.
Maybe, but in my opinion, I've had the opportunity to interview the same candidates, and I have always agreed with the members of my committee that I share the search committee with on the candidates that I feel are most appropriate for the job. Unfortunately, I don't think that a lot of women that have applied for these jobs in particular have presented themselves as very strong candidates.
Okay. Well, I mean, the other side of that coin is just jobs in general as opposed to administration. And so I think that the fact that there are more women in biology, a lot more graduates, a lot more women with degrees from undergraduate on up in biology, could be both good and bad, since they're competing for a limited number of positions in universities in particular. It's not like there are many more biology faculty positions than there are chemistry or physics or whatever, right? So
true.
You get a lot more people competing, and that means that fewer people are getting those jobs. And I was reading that only 14% of biology PhDs, hate to tell you this, find tenure-track jobs within 6 years after getting their PhD. And so they get stuck in postdoc positions working in labs, basically doing the grunt work for fairly low pay.
Yes.
And can stay that way for a long time. So
yes, I've seen that and heard the same thing. And we recently had a speaker at our Appalachian Student Research Forum named Dr. Paula Steffen. She's a professor of economics at Georgia State University. And she's also a research associate for the National Bureau of Economic Research. She has written a book called How Economics Shapes Science. And she gave a talk about how PhD positions in general are very, very small compared to the number of PhDs we're cranking out as a nation. And women are settling for the lower pay and the postdoc positions rather than trying to go for the high pay positions because of the rate of acceptance.
Well, you've been funded by a National Science Foundation Fellowship, which is a real good thing. And what do you see for yourself as your future career path in biology?
I would like to continue the research track, but I want to spend part of my time in industry. So I'm very interested in the technology and the instrumentation that I have used in my research and actually helping other researchers integrate that type of technology into their own research.
Well, Spider Woman, we wish you lots of luck in that and lots of serotonin in your life.
Thank you so much.
We're going to have to wrap it up there, Jennifer. We're at the end of the show, and it's been very interesting. If you want to read an also interesting New York Times article about this topic, just Google The Lives of Sociable Spiders. That's the easiest way to tell you to do it. The Lives of Sociable Spiders, and the New York Times article will come up that kind of covers this topic. Thank you, Jennifer Price, so much for being on with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.